measure of safety for you, as she warded with the paranoid focus of an escaped murderer, and therefore half as tightly as you did. You got better autopsies of her encounters with beasts than you did from your own, as Augustine was wont to explain significantly more to her than either he or Mercy did to you. But by the sown tongue, those fucking runes, those candied white and gold striped rooms, those crystal chandeliered rooms with a bed as big as some of the penitential cells back home. You'd hated them from first sight, as instantaneously as Ianthe took a fancy to them. You despised the cobwebby, over-ornate furniture, with filigree on curlicue on flourish, the masses of embroidery thread, the hangings on everything, swathe of fabric atop another swathe of fabric, squashed down on a plush divan that rustled if you sat on it. And most upsettingly, the paintings. They were life-sized nudes in languorous attitudes, generally in oils, and all of the same two persons. They were enthusiastically executed. The duo posing held a variety of objects, both likely and unlikely. You had once been fool enough to recommend that Ianthe take them down, at which point she had rustled up another from the bathroom and hung it in pride of place above an overpainted dresser. It was not that you were a prude. It was simply that sitting in a room with those paintings was like having a long visit with someone who kept laughing at their own puns. But despite the violently awful nudes, the excess of latticework, Ianthe, you were a frequent visitor to her den. You took such a pitiful pleasure in Nona Jesimus, now that you had spent months being Harrowhark the First. As God said, you might be the ninth saint, but you could never be ninth again. Except when you closed Ianthe's door. "It's down to your want of ambidexterity, Tridentarius," you said, giving her the same sickly pleasure in nomenclature. "It's not exactly mathematics. You are trying to fight with a sword in your wrong hand." "I'm not even trying to fight with a sword. As I've been told tiresomely often, a half-cocked version of something is significantly worse than not being cocked at all." Despite the fact that you had said, "not being cocked at all," Ianthe only slurped angrily at her soup, making a sound like custard going down a flute. "Tell me to stop breathing," she said. "I have, on multiple occasions," you said. "You won't understand. It's utterly instinctual. It doesn't matter if I try to fight from a distance. I'll flinch at something, and then Babs will kick in, and the arm won't work. You cannot pass the blame onto your burnt-up soul. It's psychological." "Bullshit," she said with vehemence. Babs indicated a very bad day. She so rarely mentioned her cavalier. "Augustine is critical, I take it." "Augustine told me they might as well smother me along with you." You were only astonished that you had any ego left to bruise. She took another spoonful of soup and said, her whey-coloured face dissatisfied, "He says the same thing you do. Psychological. Says I persist in being damaged for my own enjoyment." Still cold and very weary, you laid your sword at your feet and sat yourself down in a high-backed armchair with a frill around the bottom, done up in citrine stripes. Ianthe's rooms were undoubtedly more luxurious than yours, and more interestingly appointed, having belonged for centuries to a long-dead lictor, with time enough to come back every so often and furnish them to taste. But that long-dead lictor still seemed to sit in all the chairs and lie in the bed and shave by the water pump sink, and you were relieved that your rooms contained no ghosts but your own. You said, "There's nothing wrong with the arm." "It's not mine," Ianthe said vehemently. "Then cut it off." "So typically ninth." "Let your vaunted lictoral abilities kick in," you said. "See if it regrows." It won't, she said, taking you quite seriously. Teachers said lictors don't survive decapitation and that a lost limb would heal as a stump. And I know that if I try to make myself a new arm, I'll leave something out. If it's not perfect, it won't work, and I won't want it. The once princess of Ida did not say this petulantly, but used the resigned, rather furrowed tones of someone mildly aggrieved by self-understanding. You suggested, "So get the Saint of Joy to do it. She can be relied upon for physiological perfection." "Oh, you crack up," said Ianthe, not lifting her eyes from her soup. "I personally would not let our eldest sister regrow any of my limbs," you said, "but if perfection is what you desire..." "Boo to that," said Ianthe. You grew bored. "Teach her, then." "He'd tell me how wonderful it would be to do it myself. We're not all teachers' sweet little darlings for whom he would do anything," she remarked. "I have never been good at attracting indulgent fathers." You bristled, but had no adequate comeback. You were busy massaging your itching fingertips, which were still red and sore. The cellular degradation was subtle enough that you were healing one layer at a time to ensure you'd got everything. Not for you, the smooth stump of a regenerated lictor. You had to do everything yourself. Yet you also would not turn to God, who might heal you in one blinding, soul-nauseating instant, flensing you utterly from the bones upward, and who might also awkwardly pat you on the shoulder, or look at you with that solemn, half-troubled smile that you both craved and hated. "Then, I do not know what to tell you," you remarked, "except that if you persist in asking for my opinion, at least pretend that you want it." Ianthe pushed away her empty soup bowl and sat up, looking at you, stolen eyes narrowing with a sudden spurt of inspiration. Her paste blonde hair fell lankly over a face that should have been beautiful, and over shoulders that should have been exquisite, but only contributed to the general impression of a wax figure in a pink dolly dress. You had never been given the option to play with dolls, but given hindsight, you could not see yourself ever volunteering to have done so. "But you might do it," she said softly. You saw her looking at the necklet of bone that peeked out from the collar of your shirt, the top of your homebrew exoskeleton. "You could do it, Harrowhag, and maybe I'd even let you, seeing as we're comrades in arms, seeing as we're intimates." You stood up, more than a little repulsed, and your exoskeleton creaked as you bent to pick up the two-handed sword. "I am not perfection yet when it comes to meat," you said. "I'm not saying I wouldn't be close, but you want something I can't give, nor is it something I'm prepared to give. Being honest, I am mildly disgusted you asked. Is there soup left in the kitchen?" "Oh, heaps," said Ianthe, who appeared not to have taken offence at your rejection. It was so impossible to tell with Ianthe. "I made it. It's vile." Were there less likely bedfellows now than you and she, the daughters of mystical Dreaber and self-regarding Ida? It was not a connection formed of any mutual admiration. If anything, the more you saw of Ianthe, the less likely you were to mistake her for likable. She made herself like an over-decorated cake, covered so thickly in icing and fondants and gums that it would take serious excavation to find any bread. As a necromancer, she was a genius, though you thought she relied too much on shortcuts and circumventions. She had an exceptionally fine mind. She was not afraid of rigor. She was also obsessed with what might lie beneath the river. And, though this was a touch hypocritical coming from you, but never mind, a fucking crank. But a crank who had attained lictorhood. A crank whom you are now obliged to call sister, though you thought it hurt her to call anyone sister much more than it hurt you. A crank whom a dead self had respected enough to include in the work. A crank who had found you distracted nearly to death, beside yourself, disgraced, having thrust your blade straight through a dead woman's sternum and simply said, "Wish you'd taken off her arms." Perhaps there were more likely bedfellows, but yours hadn't killed you yet. Chapter 14. The Mithraeum, the seat of the first reborn, the sanctuary of the Emperor of the Nine Houses, the bolt hole of God, the removing place of hallowed bones, and the ossuary of the steadfast. A space station hidden 40 billion light-years from the ever-burning light of Dominicus, lit by thanagetic starlight, set in the midst of the circumstellar disk, an ancient jewel within so much dead gravel. Your new homestead was perched in the middle of an asteroid field, made up of concentric rings like a jeweler's toy. It consisted of habitation quarters, a donut ring of them on the outer edge, an inner ring of preparation rooms, a couple of laboratories, a reading room that was bigger than Dreaber, and a storage lazarette, where the foodstuffs were held frozen in time, unperishable. The other lictors complained that there was a strange aftertaste to thousand-year-old food, kept necromantically pure, but you couldn't taste it. There was also a water replenishment plant and incidental rooms. The chapel and God's rooms were at the centre. Everything else was for the dead. Arrayed were the bones of the dead, and the bodies of the dead, and the mummified heads of the dead, and the retrieved flesh and skeleton arms of the dead, preserved immediately after they had been blown off the bodies of the previously living, and the ashes of the dead, and the hair of the dead, and the fingernails of the dead, and the folded skins of the dead, and the eyes of the dead, jarred in long and exquisite crystal containers filled with aldehydes. A lictor, sitting on the outside of the rocky ring that haloed the Mithraeum, would not think it hidden. They would see it as a screaming beacon of thanagy, a burning gyre of death, letters writ large in space, "Here is the graveyard, and we are the graves!" Your first months of lictorhood passed in an echoing, vaulted set of sterile rooms specially allotted to you. They were neutrally coloured in whites and greys and blacks, scrupulously clean, and relatively empty of bones. Unlike Ianthe's, they had never been used. They had been intended for a lictor who had never slept between their sheets, or hung their clothes in the closets, or bathed their face in the water pump sink. To you, who had lived and breathed the aged dust of family members past, and worn their clothes and used their things, to get an unused set of rooms was new and enticing. You folded your clothes into drawers that had never seen clothes and kept the few small items in your bureau neat and organized, finding some measure of satisfaction in returning each night to such a place. You had never become content, and you were still helpless, but you might take chilly gratification in the small things. No servants here, in the bolt hole of the Necrolord Prime. Not a construct in sight. You all cooked your own food, or at least Mercy Morn cooked, and Augustine cooked, and even God himself cooked. You did not know about the other. Augustine was deigning to teach Ianthe, or at least make the attempt, but you did not see cookery in your future. You so rarely ate for pleasure that it was beyond imagining that you would become a normal human being who learnt how to make a sandwich. You were born of the ninth house, even if you had risen to the first, and you were happy with a cold collation. Ingredients could be taken from the storeroom and eaten as they were, in the broad steel kitchens so antique in their style, chrome-brushed countertops, wide square ovens, and a ring where a gas-lit fire came out if you swiveled a dial. Often you could find the Emperor of the Nine Houses there, sitting at one of the Plex counters and drinking from a chipped mug of hot coffee. He was wholly teacher now. His personal sitting room, a quietly appointed little space with a few chairs and a low table all comfortably faded with wear, had become a familiar sanctum. The rest of his private chambers remained a forbidden tomb. You'd traditionally been drawn to forbidden tombs, but this one repelled even your curiosity. The doors were always locked, and you nurtured no ambition to see them otherwise. He often summoned you for a theoretical lesson, or the cups of tea you still hated, but would have rather seen your skin flagellated off than say so, or simply to sit in silence. He had a trick of asking you to come over and talk, and then never actually talking, but sitting with you, watching the asteroids continue their graceful orbit around a thanogenic star. Once you found him with a sheaf of flimsy spread out over the low table, months-old reports, and he was embarrassed. God was embarrassed. "I still think about it," he confessed. "The 18,000, the radiation missiles. Augustine says thinking about it before we endure number 7 is folly. But the way I see it, if I fail with number 7, nothing matters. If we win, then this is the thing that matters most." It was always I when God ideated failure, as though the rest of you were not accountable for anything. You sat in your lustrous white robe, trying to appreciate the taste of black tea with milk in it, trying to look as though you might at any moment take the hard biscuit and place it in the tea as he did. The god of the unstilled mandible always gave you a biscuit, and you said, "Who did it, Lord?"
"B.O.E., I'm assuming," he said, a bit absently.
Then he paused at your confusion and said, "That's an acronym for a group of maniacs.
A cult who came to our attention maybe 5,000 years ago. We stumbled on them during one of our pushes into deep space. Stumbled. They'd been looking for us the whole time. They hate the Nine Houses."
You said, "I have never heard of them."
"You might have by another name, or simply as nameless insurgents. They prefer to present themselves as a kind of organic reaction, not a single coherent group. In fact, their existence depends on a secretive central organization that sends its agents to people we encounter outside the Nine Houses, to populated planets we're stewarding, and turns them against us from the shadows. But I know about them, and the Lictors know about them. They upped their game about 25 years before you were born. They'd gotten a demagogue, a charismatic leader who wasn't content to work behind the scenes. Hotspots flared up, but we took them down, cell by cell, bone by bone."
You remained silent, fingering the biscuit thoughtfully, developing the fiction that you might eat it sometime in the next myriad. Teacher quirked his eyebrows close together and looked at you with those oil-on-carbon eyes and said,
"I think they were behind Kithereya's coming to Canaan House. That's a damned sight more terrifying to me even than old nukes they have in storage somewhere."
You said, "Kithereya planned to lure you back to the Nine Houses, to attract a resurrection beast to kill you, I surmise."
"Lure is a strong word. I still think it was a crime of passion. I'm not saying she didn't have other reasons. It's just that I think some of them were heartbreakingly simple. I could have gotten through to her, given time," said God. "Time. It's always time. She was overworked and underloved. Whenever something needed doing, she'd always say, 'Me. I will.' And because she acted as though she had a leaven of selfishness to her, it was easy to say, 'Of course,' not recognizing how many times she'd said, 'I will,' not recognizing how she worked herself into the grave.
You said, a seventh house flaw, a fatal longing for the picturesque.
I understand the houses have crystallized into types, he said, and he dipped his biscuit into his tea and ate it quickly before the sodden part could lose coherency and fall into the mug.
You did not understand why anyone ate these biscuits or drank this tea.
But they got to her, Harrow. I know they got her on side, though I'm damned if I know how they even got to be in the same room. BOE hates necromancers and necromancy. It's their fundamental tenet. And Kitherea? She would have been their bogeyman. A lictor. My hand!
You were finding that if you held half a mouthful of tea in your mouth, it cooled, and when it was cool, it tasted more serene.
Unfortunately, while you were still figuring this trick out, the Emperor of the Nine Houses leaned back and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, looked at you seriously, and said,
Harrowhark, how many in your family? Your mother and father are dead, that much I know.
You swallowed in haste. How he knew that. The secret you had broken yourself attempting to keep hidden from the rest of the houses, from the rest of your own house. You didn't know. But you looked at his kindly, open countenance, and you said with the refreshing candor that came from talking to God,
One, since my parents ended their lives. I was the only child. My mother miscarried multiple times before I was born. I don't know how many.
His gaze didn't leave yours.
How were you born?
I don't understand.
You did understand.
Harrowhark, he said, you are a lictor. You generate too much light or too much darkness for me to look at you and make out any strong detail. But there are details I have surmised. You were awake during your first time in the river, and you performed necromancy. And believe me when I tell you, only one other person has ever done that their first time in. Keep in mind that she was an adult necromancer who went on to found the sixth house. You have achieved incredible things. I understand your personality and your background, and I understand how they might turn natural talent into you. But it doesn't account for what I see in those moments when I can see you clearly. How did they get you?
You put your cup of tea down, your biscuit still untouched, and you said, as though pushed after long interrogation,
My parents gassed 54 infants, 81 children and 65 teenagers, and harnessed that Thanagy bloom to conceive me. My mother used the resultant power to modify her ovum on a chromosomal level, so Thanagy ignition wouldn't compromise the embryo. She did this so I would be a necromancer.
The Emperor of the Nine Resurrections looked at you for a long time, and then he swore very quietly beneath his breath. You thought you understood, but then he said,
This was all so different before we discovered the scientific principles.
I am assured they had no previous research to go by. They came up with it themselves.
God said, a little bewildered, That's not quite what I mean. But to concentrate so much Thanagy into so precise a task, like using a nuclear detonation to power a sewing machine, the ovum ought to have been obliterated at a subatomic level. Do you understand what they did?
Intimately, you said. They explained it to me when I was very young. I could draw the theorem mathematics if you gave me some flimsy.
No. I don't mean mechanically. Conceptually. To all intents and purposes, your mother and father committed a type of resurrection, he said, They did something nigh on impossible. I know, because I have committed the same act, and I know the price I had to pay. Phallogenetic modification of an embryo is difficult enough, but to achieve the same thing with Thanagy.
You gave a helpless half-shrug. My parents were not flesh magicians, you said. But they were the greatest necromancers the Ninth House had yet produced.
No doubt, said the Emperor. But Harrowhark, even as the product of two obvious geniuses, you are a walking miracle, a unique theorem, a natural wonder.
You looked at him, and you said, I have just told you that I am the product of my parents' genocide. The Emperor set down his tea and finished off his biscuit, and did that terrible thing that he did on occasion. He reached over to touch your shoulder in that brief, tentative way, the lightest and swiftest of gestures, as though afraid that he might burn you. Your mother had guided your hands over bloating corpses. Your father had held down the corners of great tomes, and his sleeve had brushed your 6-year-old fingers as he showed you how best to turn their pages. Both of them had pressed a rough rope made of coated fibre into your hands. You recalled the pressure from their palms, their attempts to be gentle. When the Emperor touched you, your body recalled, unbidden, each rare and terrible touch committed by your mother and father. God said, I will shepherd your dead 200. I will take on their burden to mourn and cherish in more ways than you'll understand right now. And I'll remember your parents, who did such a god-awful thing to my people and theirs. I will remember it until the universe contracts in on itself and wipes clean what they did, and makes blank such an indelible stain. I acknowledge to you and to infinity that I am the Emperor of the Nine Houses, the Necrolord Prime, and that their stain must be regarded as my stain. Consider it my crime, Harrowhark. I pledge myself to making it right. A red heat had begun at your exoskeleton's necklet, travelled up your throat, darkened your face beneath your paint until you felt as though you had been held too close to a stove. You said,
Lord, you can't.
Teacher.
Teacher, have mercy on me. Please don't tell anyone.
A child's plea. Nobody has to know. To God. For a moment he changed. He grew angry, and you thought it was at the rank foolishness, the irresponsibility of what you'd said. Those monstrous, unnatural eyes narrowed, and his mouth became hard as the stones and rocks that had made up the planetoid you'd later slaughter. For a moment, you perceived a hint of his great immortal age, of an enormous distance between you, of an ignition too bright for you to conceive. You were an insect standing before a forest fire. You were a cell beholding a heart.
Harrowhark, nobody has the right to know, he said fiercely. Nobody has the right to blame you. Nobody can judge. What has happened, and there's no putting it back in the box. They wouldn't understand. They don't have to. I officially relieve you from living in fear. Nobody has to know.
That night in your bed, you did not weep. Your body tried and failed to produce tears. Afterward, God was more careful with you than ever. And he had been careful before. Sometimes you caught him glancing at you, as if he was trying to see something in the confines of your face. But whatever he was looking for, it was not what your parents had done. At the time, you swore that you would tell him about the tomb. You would find it within yourself to admit that also. You had never told anyone about the tomb, but you would tell him.
You were to tell him if he asked. No. That was equivocation. You would tell him of your own free will, and be glad of any punishment he saw fit to give you. Before you'd left him then, when your tea had cooled sufficiently that you were no longer required to drink it, you'd asked, "What does BOE stand for?"
"Blood of Eden," he'd said slowly.
"Who is Eden?"
"Someone they left to die," said God wearily. "How sharper than the serpent's tooth, etc. Harrow, if you bother to remember anything from my ramblings, please remember this. Once you turn your back on something, you have no more right to act as though you own it."
At the time, that had made perfect sense to you.
Chapter 15. One other consolation was the body. She kept close by in the months that followed. She walked around in an old blood-stained copy of the scintillating first house robes, and you startled whenever you saw her. But you took enormous comfort in watching her pace your sterile, empty quarters, and in watching her kneel before the mummified assembly that lived within the corridors and apses of the Mithraeum. The greatest gift she gave you was that when you laid yourself down on your bed to sleep fully clothed, you would dream of her with an uncanny, profound regularity. You could not, in fact, dream of anything else. In dreaming, you would return to your old bed back in the sanctuary of Dreaber, your childhood bed, getting a little bit short in the toes for you now. You prayed at its foot, no longer bracketed by either gruesome great aunt. Instead, opposite your cot would be the body, her hands neatly folded on the ancient shawl that your mother had always laid on the bed, the electric light in the sconce shining down on the firm musculature of her forearms, the calluses upon those dead palms. Her eyes she kept closed, each wet and frozen lash brushing cheeks blanched by expiration. "I'm afraid," you'd say. She would say softly, in the voice that prickled each hair on your scalp with a sweet, deep electricity, "What of, Harrowhark? Tonight, I am afraid to die." "That is the same fear as failure," she said once. "You don't fear dying. You can tolerate pain. You are afraid that your life has incurred a debt that your death will not pay. You see death as a mistake," you said a little bitterly.
"What else is it?"
"The dead course of the locked tomb, the death of the emperor, the maiden with the sword and the chains, the girl in the ice, the woman of the cold rock, the being behind the stone that could never be rolled away," said in half-confused tones she had never taken with you.
"I don't know. I died once. No, twice."
But then she had said no more. Another time you said,
"I'm afraid of myself. I'm afraid of going mad."
Another time,
"I'm still afraid of Kitherea the First."
And,
"I am afraid of God."
And again,
"Do I have Ortis's eyes? Are these ones mine? I never really looked at them. Beloved, what were my eyes like?"
Unfortunately, that time she answered. Sometimes she didn't. Sometimes she talked to you quietly about discursive subjects, and sometimes she didn't say a thing. But now, that which was buried insensate said quite calmly, "She asked me not to tell you." You awoke, flat on the floor in front of the water pump sink, screaming until your throat was broken. When you stared at your bloodshot eyes in the mirror and tried to remember Ortis Nigenad's, you couldn't recall a difference. They were both that deep and fathomless black, the colour Ianthe called black roses, because Ianthe was over-familiar and frankly a pervert. You tried to imagine Ortis's sad, heavy weariness staring at you from your own mirror. It did not work. You were both terribly relieved and terribly frightened.
Chapter 16.
In the first few weeks you had created a new cipher, based off the original, with a few mathematical changes just in case Ianthe had gleaned too much data from the envelopes. In this, you started to collate your thoughts and findings on the lictors around you, a pitiful memorandum of opinion and perceived fact, mostly useless, gathered in the hope that by examining your findings in aggregate, you might somehow receive wisdom. You had always liked to write notes. You grieved the loss of your diary from Canaan House, but your things had been filtered through Ianthe back to you, which meant that all you got was a small supply of sacramental paint and your old clothes. When you inquired about the diary, you received the blunt response that it had been burned on your own orders. Your section on Ianthe was very short.
Ianthe, Whilom Tridentarius the First. Unworthy of trust. Suspects me mad.
You should have known the former, and the latter was all your own fault. The first slip was the matter of Kithareia's tomb.
The Emperor had laid the corpse of Kithareia the First in a small chamber off the central residential atrium, a little too close for comfort. This atrium was a well of corridor shafts off to other rings of the station, and its floor was an exquisite mandala of hand bones under glass. Each metacarpal dyed the colour of its house, dominated by ombres of white to crimson for the second, and white to navy for the fourth. Around the mandala were tiles of raised brown stone that rapped sharply when one stepped on them. There were no windows to speak of, just strong electric lights from round holes in the ceiling, and in the middle hung a delicate chandelier of white crystals. The room was pillared with three massive steel-edged columns on either side, each a cacophony of exposed wire under smoked glass. These wires were thronged about with bone, with glistening strands of fat wrapped around some of the threads of copper instead of plex. They reeked of naked phallogy, and their purpose was still not immediately apparent to you. Every so often, a whole arm bone would peek out of this nest of soft yellow fat-wrapped wire. You assumed it was not another memorial. There were 9 decorative arches on the eastmost side of the room. You had by now investigated each arch carefully. The brown floor tiles were inlaid halfway up the walls in these arches, and then became glass of every different colour, and in the centre of each polychromatic sweep was a sword bracket. Some of the brackets were empty, and some held rapiers. One in particular always drew you back to it. A black rapier with a basket hilt formed of ebon wires. At the termination of each wire was a single canine tooth, and the end, pommel, was a soft, worn knob of black-dyed bone. The side room they put Kithareia in was not so decorated. The door was always open to reveal her laid out on a stretcher, with candles all around her that never seemed to go out or melt down, covered by those chubby blush rosebuds that also never seemed to open or rot. In these 2 miracles you detected the hand of the Emperor Divine. Every so often you saw him in there, having a quiet conversation with the body in the same way one would talk to a sleeping child. Sometimes Augustine was there, and once Mercy. You never saw the other. You had ventured in there yourself often, even though it was gauche, even though you had done enough damage. Something about her troubled you, and you thought it was the paranoid madness, but you couldn't be sure. Your brain told you that the arms so chastely crossed over that skewered chest had been moved a little. Your brain told you that the lips were a little too parted.
When you had told teacher of your worries, you little imbecile, he had grimaced and worried his forehead with his thumb momentarily and said,
Nobody would touch her, Harrow. I haven't.
I know, I just...
Augustine wouldn't out of love, he said. Mercy wouldn't out of superstition. And Autus.
He looked at you carefully, as always when he mentioned the other. The name always came awkwardly to his lips.
Autus wouldn't, out of respect, believe me. He wouldn't even think of such a thing. Doesn't sound Ianthe's style either.
But I thought... I think perhaps you should try to avoid that room, he had suggested sympathetically. You had burned. You had been molten with shame and resentment. You had been reduced entirely to flame. Yet for all that, you now walked devoutly past the doorway where lay the peaceful corpse of Kithareia the First. You entered that doorway in your waking nightmares, watched, lost in the hallucination of your mind's eye, as those frozen fingers twitched into arcane formations, as each bare toe on each chilly foot shivered as though the corpse had been touched with an electrified wire. Your mistake was the time you stopped just outside the room, arrested by muffled creaks at the edges of your hearing. Tortured past any shame, you turned to Ianthe and said, Do you perceive any sound from within the mortuary chapel? She said. Do you try to sound as portentous as possible, or does it just sort of happen naturally?
Answer the damn question, Tridentarius.
You did not call her Tridentarius outside of a locked room, so she looked at you queerly and said, No. And then, as though more enlightened by what she saw in your face, gently, No, I don't, crazy cakes. And you did not ask her again.
There was so much more you might have written.
Eyes have not reverted to lilac since the river. Arm is continued weak point, still cries at night. Cannot actually be anemic, considering diet primarily red meat and apples. Regularly undersleeps. Begrudges my relationship with teacher. Knows too much. Your other sections were more substantial. Augustine Wylam Quinque, the First, Saint of Patience. Why? The name had been easy to get. You had simply found him at his mid-afternoon cup of tea and cigarette. The Saint of Patience was as regular as a worm and had no apparent fear of fire, or having to regrow his own taste buds, and asked him outright.
Ah, finally my biographer, he had said, rubbing his hands together in a show of deep satisfaction. I've been waiting for this, Harrow Hark. A-U-G-U-S-T-I-N-E, Augustine. Height 6 feet, visage can be described as attractive but grave, eyes can be scenarious, and if you're appreciative of poor little Kith's tradition... She was always poor little Kith while he smiled and looked directly at you. It's Augustine Alfred. Alfred was 5'10". Let's get that down for posterity. He was my other half. Get that down too, for the human interest aspect.
You were momentarily revolted by the apparent Fifth House tradition.
You and your cavalier were... wedded?
He did not turn a hair at wedded, or, as Ianthe would, say back exactly what you had in a high-pitched voice, for which you would one day jerk her white and beating heart from her colourless ribcage and eat it dripping before her. You did not examine... eat it dripping, as you maybe should have done. He just laughed in the uproarious slap-your-thigh way that the Saint of Patience always laughed. It was not a laugh that really ever seemed to find anything genuinely funny. When this peal of performative humour had died down, Augustine said,
Bless you, sis. He was my brother.
Killed own sibling. Augustine the First was the closest thing you had ever experienced to human plex.
On the outside, he was perfectly painted, in a sort of antique Fifth House style, all manners and politesse and over-easy familiarity. Yet there was nothing inside him but an equally easy contempt. It was as though 10,000 years had built up a shell and left a space at the centre. Nothing seemed to touch Augustine. He was effervescent and charming in a way you found a little tedious and flip, especially on those teeth-grinding occasions when God called you all to eat a social meal together. But there was never any real emotion, or reaction, or opinion. His mouth said one thing, and his face could contort itself into any number of silly expressions, but those eyes were devoid of substance. Cinereus was at least correct. Ash also looked solid upon first glance, but was insubstantial filth on contact. Poor relationship with Mercy Morn. You had risen this understatement of the myriad when you thought that highly strung Mercy was easily out of patience with the sillier and more frivolous Augustine in those first few weeks. He cultivated a specific expression whenever Mercy Morn was talking, an expression that was meant to say to all assembled, "At least we suffer together." And that more than once you had seen Ianthe smother a laugh at, so comical was the mouth. But that was the painted-on expression. The plex had been shaped differently. Though you often saw them pass in the hallway as if the other did not exist, you once spied a different encounter while safely ensconced in an alcove. They'd stopped in front of each other, with Mercy trying to pass left. Augustine made himself intangibly too much left to pass. Mercy trying to pass right. Augustine made himself intangibly too much right to pass, and Mercy saying tightly, "Get out of my way, you miserable ass!" Augustine had said something you did not catch, but then something you did. Back to the bad old tricks of decades past.
"Oh, as if you're my keeper, you chattering imbecile!"
"But does John know, my child?" said the saint of patience, smiling. Mercy had bristled, the nacreous whites of her robe visibly shivering.
"That," she said, "is a foul implication."
"I'm not implying anything. Does John—"
"And it's obscene the way you call him that when—"
"Mercy Morn," said Augustine lightly. "I won't fall for any of your worn-out tricks, my girl. Now look, do I have to kill you before you get us both in trouble or not?" From your vantage point, you could see that the Saint of Joy's face was a stiff white oval. Those hurricane eyes roiled within a face that was trembling and fixed. You could not see Augustine's.
She said, "Don't threaten me."
"Or what? You'll tell Daddy?"
His tone of voice hadn't changed.
"Good grief. You wouldn't get close enough to touch me, Mercy Morn. No, I am not afraid of you. You are not very nice, but you are also not very clever when it comes down to it. I'm going to give you 3 recommendations. 1 is to be in my airspace less. 2 is to stop messing around with Kith's body. 3 is to stop playing the rather dangerous game you're playing, the one you said you'd stop."
"I won't do a thing you say."
She sounded tearful now. "Don't pull that face. I know you like I know my own soul. You're thinking, if I move now, can I touch his neck before he can stop me? And hey-ho, there goes my trachea. It wouldn't matter even if you were quick enough on the draw, you know."
"As though you could ever—"
"If you killed me, I don't think he'd forgive you, you see," said Augustine. The easy, confidential tone of voice had gone. It was now flat and immovable and bored. "But if I killed you, if I stubbed you out beneath my foot, which would still be more than you deserve, then I am convinced that it would take me a mere 100 years to get John to say, 'I know why you did it, old chap, and I'm sorry,'
and for everything to come up, Augustine. You have shot your bolt too many times.
How dare!
You have rendered yourself unlovable, Mercy, said Augustine.
You are the second saint. He's sentimental over you, but don't forget that he spent the last 10,000 years on a perpetual search-and-destroy mission out of, as far as I can tell, purely symbolic retribution. John is never as sentimental as you think. Do you need me to write this down for you so you can read it to yourself each night? You are unnecessary to him. Worse still, you've become an embarrassment. I wouldn't set myself up as his replacement AL. He doesn't need another bodyguard, and even she was significantly more lucid than you are.
You'd expected a response.
None came.
You looked at the Saint of Joy, and at her expression, withdrew into your alcove, flattening yourself, lest she pick you as a target to vent her frustrations on. There was a silence from the corridor. Then Augustine broke it.
Stay away from me, Joy. I find myself so profoundly tired of looking at your face.
And his clickety-clackety footsteps sounded down the corridor. Mercy Morn's voice floated back, somewhat strangled.
But I haven't even touched Kithereia.
Afterward, you stopped seeing them in the same room, except when the Necrolord Prime called you together for dinner, and then they sat as far apart as possible.
Favours Iente.
A source of continuing annoyance to you. You'd never been anybody's favourite anything, and did not intend to start. But the idea that the Princess of Ida had managed to capture another's affection was bilious. Yet from the very start, Augustine had inclined toward her, and she had deployed her whole menagerie of coquettish smiles in return, each looking as though it had spent a month prowling the desert before being captured and put to this circus use. She was often seen at his side, fully absorbed in whatever pearls of wisdom were dropping from the Saint of Patience's lips, drinking calamitous amounts of hot tea with much the same expression, one you thought ill-suited to her shadowed eyes and white mouth, and though less calmly, taking instruction in the long training hall with its polished wooden floorboards, the wood so new you were hesitant to step on it. It was only then that they seemed at odds, as the so-called Saint of Patience ran out of it every time Ianthe put hand to rapier. He smoked his fierce cigarettes as he put her through her paces. She was always so tremendously bored by sword exercises. I thought the point was to outsource this, elder brother. You had heard her remark more than once. He would get cross quickly. From what little you could tell, her form was perfect. Her lines were exquisite. She never dropped the sword or fumbled with it, which proved again how inadequate a standard what little you could tell was. But there was something he did not like about how that right arm clutched that sword.
Let go, you heard him tell her once.
I'm assuming you mean metaphorically.
Younger sister, he said cordially. Some nice boy spent his life learning that sword for you. Now you are trying to add your opinions to his, and they are simply not worth half a toot in this hot and terrible universe. Stop holding it like it smells, or like a banana you're trying to burst. Emperor almighty, Ianthe! I've seen you do this perfectly, so why must you persist in doing it poorly?
At that, she had said a rude word, flung the sword down, and fled. Augustine finished his cigarette in a ruminative manner, and you stared at the rapier you had been given. The Emperor asked you to handle it, so you scheduled some time for handling it, with absolutely jack shit arising from the exercise.
She can do it, you know, he remarked to the air.
She simply needs to quit steeping in self-pity.
You said, humiliating her is perhaps not the best curative.
Harrowhark, he said, smiling,
tapping his cigarette out on the skull of some long-dead cohort hero. If Ianthe's opinion isn't worth a fart in a hurricane, try to imagine how much less I value yours.
So far away from Dreba, so far from your congregation and the elders and laypeople who had blushed to kiss your knucklebone prayer beads, you felt you actually had valuable information in this instance, but Ianthe's secrets were not held in common for you to spill so thoughtlessly.
Then that is your downfall, you said.
You are Anastasia come again.
In a perfect world, Augustine's cool would have warmed Mercy Morn toward you.
She did cultivate a distaste for Ianthe, but did not become any less shrill, acid, or contemptuous in your direction. Naturally, a large portion of your education fell to her. With Augustine busy, there was nobody left for you. But she more than once expressed her view that Augustine had nabbed the working baby on purpose and left her the dregs to spite her. Once when you were tired, you had said to Ianthe,
"Doesn't it chafe, carrying on after him the way you do, picking up his things, smiling with your teeth showing?"
"My teeth are extremely white, and I brush assiduously, so I see no problem showing them off," said Ianthe.
"Lighting his cigarettes and cooing. That is so fascinating, elder brother."
"I intend to take on the habit myself," said Ianthe. "Cigarettes. On a space station. What a power play."
"Do you ever wake up and think to yourself, when did the Princess of Ida become this grovelling slime?"
She smiled at you, with those teeth so brushed and white. The eyes that had once been chill lavender were now blue, patted with brown flecks, and as mocking as ever.
"Most days," she said.
"Oh, for crying out loud, Harrowhark, smiling and listening to some quite interesting stories about his 10,000 years is no hardship, especially not when it may make him think twice about leaving me to be eaten by a resurrection beast. Carrying off Corona's con for over 20 years taught me that shame is a privilege. We're puppies, you and I. I with my lame paw, and you with 3 legs missing, insisting you can make it on your own. And God help us both, because we are surrounded by wolves."
Ianthe ended this startling speech by chucking you under the chin. You were too outraged and befuddled to dodge her. She said,
"Show your endearing side, Harry. It may save your life."
Spirit magician. Another terrible understatement. Augustine was a spirit magician like the Mithraeum was a box with some bones. You did not begrudge him this expertise. Spirit magic had never been your forte. He had a lictor's power and a myriad's refinement. He taught to a curriculum you had barely known existed. The dead Harrowhark of your letters had told you to take instruction, and so did God, shepherding you and Ianthe both to take lessons from the Mithraeum's resident expert in resurrection beasts.
"It's not my primary wheelhouse," Augustine explained, "but since our last expert vanished into a large intestine, unravelled by a troop of ghosts, I'm the last spirit adept standing."
"He's being modest," said God. "The barriers between us and the river are Augustine's. He could plunge half a city into it if he wanted."
"What a gorgeously futile idea," said Augustine warmly. "I should chuck things in there more often. There's no way that could come back to haunt me. No, my lord, I am not Cassiopeia. I am a spirit generalist, and happy with my lot."
"So we're talking about ghosts and liminal spaces and hell," Ianthe said.
Ianthe always wanted everything brought back to liminal spaces and hell, as though her rooms were not enough. You could not deny an interest yourself. The saint of patience never took this bait. Dear one, I need the right moment to go to hell, but ghosts and spirits are as good a place as any to begin. You might say I like to follow energy trails back to their source. Revenants in particular are fun that way. Resurrection beasts feed like revenants. They find thalogenic planets and guzzle them up wholesale, crack them open like clams, and take the soul for meat. Then they turn all that remnant thalogy into what we call the corpus, or the hive, and the thanergy, the dead clam itself, for armour. You can ask the Saint of Duty about the thanergy transfer. You did not think this would be viable. When you look at a revenant on this side, what you're seeing is the thanergy mass that it's gathered. Usually, revenants can only inhabit things connected to them in life. The best and most desirable would be its own corpse or skeleton, or planet, if you're an RB. You've formed a bond with that thing through habit and genetics. It's your soul's preferred housing. Unfortunately, aponeumatic shock makes most of us do a blind dash away from the site of our death, resurrection beasts included. The card up the sleeve of the revenant and the resurrection beast is that it can inhabit anything it's got a connection to, anything thanergetically connected with their death. Ianthe suggested in what you saw as a low-value suck-up play. Burial implements, grave goods, any possession that they kept over time that was exposed to their thalogy and thanergy. If they were murdered, the murder weapon. Bang on, said Augustine. Even things that touched the murder weapon, though the connection's fairly weak there, and the revenant would have to be particularly bloody-minded. She pressed. Could they use thanergy they generated after death? Thanergy directly related to themselves. I mean, things they kill. You are absolutely and beautifully right, said the Saint of Patience warmly, and you were not annoyed that she had won such approbation. It was not as though your brain had failed to come to the same conclusion. You simply hadn't felt like articulating. This is how the RBs got on, having scarpered away from the Dominicus system. Resurrection beasts add to their corpus anything they've done a good solid murder to. They eat planets, they suck up the thanergy, then add bits of the planet to themselves, getting bigger and meaner each time. Your average revenant doesn't kill human beings and stick them on its outside, for which I'm devoutly thankful. The last time we eyeballed Number 7, it was over 50,000 kilometres in diameter. This is why you will be sent out to establish the perimeter, said God, as Augustine was lost in 50,000 kilometres of reverie. We can slow Number 7 if we take away its food. If we flip a planet all at once, a thalogetic death, the resurrection beast will ignore it. This is the way we used to prepare a thalogy planet for necromancy, God explained to you much later, after Mercy began schooling you in the way of butchering planetoids. No adept can perform any substantive work if they're reduced to scavenging trace thanergy. Even a master of the ninth can only do so much with a few scattered bones. So back at the start, we'd drop in a single lictor, unnoticed, to start the thanergy reaction. Not to flip the whole planet, you understand, just to get the juice flowing. He made a hand gesture for get the juice flowing, which made your head hurt. Then, within an hour or two, you could send down a team of adepts and be confident they'd have all the reserves they needed. Nowadays, we can't afford to use lictors, so the first strike falls to the men and women of the cohort, and they do a magnificent job. But the old way was neater, and kinder too, I think. Ianthe said, If the resurrection beast is that big, surely the main worry is that we'll be drawn into its gravity well. Yes, but it almost never travels as a physical revenant. That's why it's so damned hard to track beasts. Much easier if they'd just leave flattened galaxies in their wake. They travel as river projections instead. Periscoping, Cass called it. And once they do instantiate, they don't seem to want to get too close. This is where the heralds come in. Unlike normal revenants, our bees have developed external actors, and those are the things that will attack the Mithraeum. We've nicknamed this the Hive, and inside the Hive are the heralds. They'll look like independent creatures, but really, they're just extensions of it. Spider, web, hand, finger. This whole lesson took place with you, God, and Ianthe sitting at the dining table, which still smelled like breakfast, and you did not like the lack of ceremony. Augustine was leaning over the table, drawing a careful diagram on a piece of flimsy with a pencil he had borrowed from God. The resulting sketch was almost impossible to follow.
"You keep saying creatures," you said. "That is a little..."
"Nondescript," said Augustine. "I can't describe them, sis. The first time we ran into the tools of a resurrection beast, and this was just looking at them, I mean, they hadn't even engaged us. I watched a lictor, one I had never hitherto seen so much as cry out, scream like a colicky child. Another two, R.I.P.